You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, September 18th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. The literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Nation editor at large and host of All In with Chris Hayes. Chris Hayes, on his piece, The New Abolitionism, on the eve of the eve of the eve of the People's Climate March in New York City. Also on the program today, the House approves funding of Syrian rebels. And Hobby Lobby sowed the seeds of a poison fruit. Meanwhile, Manhattan has the greatest income disparity in the country. Steve Forbes on Scottish independence says it's going to usher in terrorism, of course, and poverty and deprivation. David Gregory says the media is lazy. And the Department of Justice supposedly plans to criminally charge Wall Street execs. All that and more on today's program. Before we get there first, folks, of the myriad of reasons why you may take issue with people who hold different political opinions than yourselves, apparently a new study published in the American Journal of Political Science purports to find that individuals who, with whom people agree politically, simply smell better to them. The research came from researchers at Brown, Harvard, and Pennsylvania State Universities. And they wanted to determine whether or not smell, which plays a central role in our attraction to mates, etc., etc. They wanted to determine whether or not it also plays a role in whether or not we share politics. So what happened is the researchers gathered body odors from this. I mean, this is kudos to these guys. Body odors from 146 people. They also had them describe their political ideologies. They then took the 10 most definitively liberal and definitively conservative candidates who were then at that point asked and wore gauze pads under their arms for 24 hours. The researchers then took these gauze pads and took 125 people who described their political orientation, and they had them smell these gauze pads. There were 20 of them. and rate them on a 5-point scale of attractiveness. I hope these subjects were well paid. I don't know if they were told either whether or not what they were smelling with someone's underarm BO. That may have made things a little more difficult. And the 125 subjects rated the body odor of those who shared their political ideology without knowing that, of course, the gauze pads were linked to a political ideology as being more attractive than the body odor of their ideological opponents. One specific comment, which Vox highlighted here, was that a female participant smelling the male body odor of a politically compatible male described it as the best perfume I ever smelled. But a female of the opposite political persuasion who had just smelt the same gauze was convinced that the gauze pad had gone rancid.
Wow.
Now, Vox points out that it's a fairly small sample. 10 gauze pads for conservatives, 10 gauze pads for liberals. And there were other factors they weren't able to control for. But interesting. Maybe this is something for you to try out when Thanksgiving rolls around. And if you have one of those uncles who's a conservative or a father-in-law or a mother-in-law for that matter, head over, smell their underarms and see if you find it pleasant. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, an interview I recorded with Chris Hayes yesterday about the new abolitionism. Like I say, we are just days away from the People's Climate March, and I see people pretty excited about it in New York, to be honest with you. A lot of people, disparate people, have talked to me about it. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Chris Hayes. Hey, folks, just want to give you a reminder. This show relies on members for 98.9% of its revenue, which supports both the free show and, of course, the member show that we give you as a bonus when you join. It's pennies a day. We cannot do what we do day in, day out without your support. Become a member today. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Literally a pennies a day. Your support makes this show possible. And now to that interview with Chris Hayes. We are back on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program host of All In with Chris Hayes, Chris Hayes. And also Nation Magazine editor. What are you? What is your title at Nation?
I am editor at large.
Editor at large. And
editor at large.
So, Chris, before we get started, I want to talk, obviously, about your piece from April in The Nation magazine, The New Abolitionism, and in the context of this big march that's going to be taking place in New York and protests around the world, frankly, regarding climate change. But we got to deal with this elephant in the room about this whole thing where you're apparently you haven't checked in with the PC police on.
you're talking about Girl Talk Gate.
That's right, Girl Talk Gate. How could you? It is Girl Talk to say that that the idea of ISIS invading our border is girl talk.
So last night, to explain to the listeners who are not avid Newsbusters readers, last night I made an offhanded reference, which I admit was like possibly a little on the obscure side, about the fact that this right-wing sort of trope about how ISIS is going to come through the southern border, that over the last 13 years there's actually been a whole variety of times when like this, where like sort of terrorism, you know, terrorism session and border obsession were mashed up together. And I said it's like a Girl Talk mashup of like the terrorism session, the border obsession into one. It's like a, you know, and I said that, and I said it like a Girl Talk mashup. And then Newsbusters, who dutifully watch every show on MSNBC that is ever on, wrote up that I dismissed these concerns with this frankly unfeminist term that I'm going to have to be sent to the re-education camps because I said Girl Talk, and then Gawker pointed out that, you know, who Girl Talk was and what I was saying.
Yes, Girl Talk is a DJ who mashes up sort of disparate, musical genres.
Yeah, like, you know, Marilyn Manson and Kanye West, like that sort of thing.
Kudos, they at least put a correction at the top of Newsbusters.
They did. And let me say this, weirdly, you end up having like this weird, I wouldn't say like, I'm not sure what the word is, but there's a strange little soft spot in my heart for Newsbusters insofar as like, there's some guy over there watching the show every night. Like, we're both like, it's like he and I are both there at 8 o'clock every night. It's like the cartoon where like the wolf and the sheepdog and the sheep, like, you know, clock in.
Exactly at the same time. It seems like he's clocking in a little bit late or trying to get out of work a little bit early. I would have imagined that at one point it was like, that's sort of a strange thing to say, Girl Talk. But it actually, in some ways, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but it is sort of an insight into this guy's mind, because if I heard that and didn't know the reference, which I would admit I don't know virtually any cultural references, I would say that's just a weird way. Why would that be Girl Talk? One would have to have in their mind some notion of what Girl Talk is for that to fit that bill.
Right.
Without saying, like, that's a weird turn of a phrase. I wonder, I'm just going to Google Girl Talk and see if there's something out there that I'm not aware of. But all right, be that as it may, I had to deal with that because, of course, I don't want Newsbusters to be knocking me for not knocking you for that. So
you asked the hard questions.
Indeed. All right. So let's get to this piece. I mean, this was you go to great lengths to make it clear that you're not making an analogy between the experience of slaves and the institution of slavery with the potential, I guess, deprivations and calamity that climate change could be. But you're using it as not just as an example, but maybe as the only example of what forces are aligned against making the changes that are necessary to head off a climate change calamity.
Right. So the point of the essay, you're right, I go to great lengths to basically say, I'm not making a moral comparison between burning fossil fuels and enslaving people because there is none. The point is to look at the economics of slavery for a moment, because obviously because we got rid of slavery and because the Union won the Civil War and because we now all rightly recognize it as an abhorrent evil, you know, we don't think of it as much as an economic institution because we just think, well, you know, you can't own people. That was the salient fact about it. But if you take yourself back to that time and you look at it through the lens, particularly of the slaveholders, slaves represented just a massive, massive amount of wealth. You know, you're talking about 16% of total household wealth in assets in the entire country. Eric Foner said that slaves as property were worth more than all the banks, factories, and railroads in the country put together in 1860. Think what would happen if you liquidated banks, factories, and railroads. So you are talking about trillions in current, in term terms, the best estimate is somewhere around $10 trillion of wealth that was just evaporated overnight. I mean, you know, slaveholders own this wealth, and then they didn't. And then they were waging a war, you know, to preserve the Southern way of life, to, you know, states' rights, but they were just waging a war to, like, keep a lot of money in their pockets.
And we should say that when we talk about it as wealth, it is not simply, obviously, what is paid for a slave at that time, but what the wealth that is generated by that free labor.
That's right. That's right. And obviously it's central, you know, there's a way in which actually the analogy extends even further, not just an analogy between the amount of wealth represented by the ownership of slaves and today the amount of wealth represented by known fossil fuel reserves, but actually the fact that slaves were energy in the agrarian South. I mean, that was the human labor was the fuel that got stuff done, right? I mean, in fact, the South lagged behind the North along every conceivable industrial metric almost precisely because it was so reliant on the cheap, relatively cheap source of energy that was the human bodies that they had in bondage. And so, you know, in almost a literal sense, slaves were the energy that powered the South. They powered the cotton fields, which were, you know, some of the highest grossing acres of land anywhere in the world during the cotton boom leading up to the war, when, you know, the South is exporting tons of cotton to England, where Southern politicians are getting up on the floor of the U.S. Senate and saying cotton is king, that everyone must cower before it, including the Bank of England. You know, that it was the fuel. Slave labor was the fuel that ran an economy that was, people, I think, don't quite think about this, was booming in 1840 and 1850. It was actually going through a tremendous bubble. It was like the equivalent of the housing boom in terms of both the price of land in the South, the price of cotton being exported, and the value of slaves themselves, because importation of slaves had been banned in the early 19th century. So slave owners then had control, essentially. And I know all of this sounds horrific because I'm describing actual human beings with like with feelings and souls in these sort of awful, you know, bloodless economic terms, but that's precisely the evil of the institution.
Right.
That they then had control of the supply. And so, and because cotton was so lucrative, because slaves were the means by which cotton was grown and extracted in the South, slaves became more and more and more valuable over time. In fact, there was a sort of boom in the price of it. So all of these economic factors came together to mean that what abolishing slavery on the eve of civil war meant making a political demand of a certain set of owners of capital that they walk away from $10 trillion of it.
And go ahead.
Yeah. And the point of the piece is that right now the climate math tells us we got to leave about 80% of known fossil fuel reserves in the ground, and the present value of that is a little difficult to calculate. Some have said it's as much as 20 trillion, some say 13 trillion, but let's say it's 10. Let's be really like conservative, right? Let's say it's 10. Well, the only real precedent for that is of a political demand that required the liquidation of that much wealth, is the abolition of slavery.
And I want to circle back to that notion of, and you know, again, I mean, I think we're obviously trying to be extremely sensitive to discussing slaves as the commodity, but that is the way that they were perceived at that time. And
right.
When you discuss this commodity as something that is essentially low cost energy that that it produces, you know, other goods. And the fact that they, the South, had access and was so reliant upon that commodity that it inhibited their evolution of their economy relative to the North. And that's another analogy, just yep. to tease that out, as to what we're experiencing with
right.
carbon-based fuels.
That's right. Now, you know, economists will talk about something called the resource curse, which is the phenomenon whereby countries with very rich natural wealth holdings tend to have all sorts of developmental obstacles. Right? They have a hard time producing stable political systems, representative democracies, stable uncorrupt political institutions, because the process of extraction is kind of a corrupting process. It means wealth is concentrated. It means everyone's trying to sort of getting bought off by those interests. And, you know, you look at Saudi Arabia as sort of the classic example of, you know, a place. Well, the South was a version of that. The South was a version of a place that was had a very small, tightly concentrated wealth in the planter class, who represented a very small percentage of the population. But, I think it was that the majority of what would in today's terms be millionaires, the overwhelming majority of millionaires on the eve of the Civil War were in the South, right? So, and yet the South's per capita GDP was far, far lower. So the South as a whole is much less economically developed on the eve of the Civil War than the North. It's much, much less industrialized. Its production output is far smaller, but that wealth is much more intensely concentrated, and that all relies upon this system. And what it means is, you know, in the same way that if you have access to a very cheap fuel, you will not innovate to get new ones, right? You will not come up with ways to mechanize. And this is true in places that have very low labor costs, right? In Germany, everything's done by robots because labor cost in Germany is high, and so it's worth it to invest in robots to do stuff, right? In Bangladesh, everything is done by hand. You know, clothing is assembled by hand, and that's because labor is cheap. So very cheap labor and very bountiful extractive resources put economies on a glide path that stops them from incentivizing innovation in coming up with. So, you know, there's a certain way in which we are in this position where we're dependent on this fossil fuel carbon economy. And because for a long time, you know, the U.S. was the carbon king of the world, that, you know, we particularly haven't had to even do the basic kinds of efficiencies that you see elsewhere in the world. I mean, I was in rural Turkey several years ago, and I went to my hotel in a tiny town that was not very wealthy, and I mean, it was poor. It was a poor rural Turkish town in a hotel that was kind of shambles, and they had a setup so that the key was connected to a little like slot that you had to put into a little mechanical device that would keep the lights on in the room,
mm-hmm.
and then you'd take it out and the lights would shut off. And I remember having the thought a year later, I think it was, I went to Netroots Nation in Pittsburgh, where we were all staying in this very fancy LEED Platinum green building hotel that had this technology. It was the first time I'd seen it in the U.S., and I thought, a year ago in rural poor Turkey, this Baker's mechanism, which was like, don't let people waste power in a hotel room by leaving it on, by leaving the lights on when they're not there, that was already there, right? And the reason is, you know, all those efficiencies matter a lot more to places that don't have the kind of material and resource wealth that we do. And so that's another way in which we there's a similarity.
So we've been hampered not just by the abundance in terms of it's made us lazy, you know, despite, you know, Jimmy Carter in his sweater 40 years ago now saying, you know, let's turn down the heat a little bit to save some oil. but also about the sort of the broader innovation that would come in creating alternatives.
That's right, exactly, and the sort of the story of the South and North is a pretty good example of that. I mean, electrification, is famously comes to the North much sooner than the South. In fact, the South lags tragically hilariously behind. The Tennessee Valley Authority, obviously, the New Deal and FDR electrifies a lot of the Tennessee Valley. LBJ, I think, if I'm not mistaken, grows up without electricity. So, you have the legacies of that for a long time, and that's the way kind of innovation curves work, right? There's a huge kind of first mover advantage. There's a huge advantage to sort of density of networks, particularly with something like electricity, where it's the more there is, the cheaper it is. And so in all these ways, I think there's these analogies between the problems from a macroeconomic perspective and the opposition and challenges presented by the way that the slave economy functioned and the set of incumbent interests it produced and the political moral demand that those incumbent interests take it on the chin, take it in their pocketbooks, and what we face now with fossil fuels.
And in some respects, I mean, we're talking about in the context of the institution of slavery, it cost, the road to abolition basically cost 600,000 lives in a civil war. And in that context, the benefits or there's a whole series of other things that were also sort of fighting against forcing that relinquishing of those assets. We talk about just general morality of slavery, but also the benefits of slavery were not as dispersed as the benefits of cheap oil.
That's exactly right. Yeah, exactly. And that's a really important point. There is a sense in which everyone in the U.S. benefited from slavery who wasn't a slave. The fact is that people got cheap cotton. And there's all sorts of really interesting historical literature about the way that the slave trade made tons of people very wealthy in the North, and that money sort of flowed around. So there is some sense in which it wasn't. We should be clear: the economic benefit of slavery did not just redound to the planter class. It flowed throughout American society, and the amount of wealth expropriated from the slaves was a premium and a boon to the white non-slave population throughout the country. That said, a very small percentage of the country and a small percentage of the South actually own slaves, and we all use electricity.
What is problematic on some level with this country sort of dealing with its legacy of slavery was that there was probably not the level of awareness or the relationship to the benefit that white people living in the North, let's say, were getting from slavery versus I go to the gas tank, and fill up my car, or
yep.
I turn on
yep.
the light,
exactly.
or I have plastics all
That's
around
right.
me.
That's right. And you see this sometimes with, these occasional political turmoil that is produced by spiking oil prices. And remember that the greatest threat America faced in the summer of 2008 before the entire bottom fell out of the global economy was that gas was $4.50 a gallon. And that was like all Barack Obama and John McCain were talking about. You remember that moment
mm-hmm.
in the campaign? It's been totally lost to history and wiped out because of what happened afterwards. But that was, the drill baby drill days and the making fun of Barack Obama for saying to check the air pressure in your tires. So there's a price sensitivity there that is profound and real, and it's part of it. You're right that it creates a set of incumbent interests against change that are bigger than just the fossil fuel companies. Of course, from the consumer perspective, right, it's all hidden to you anyway. Like, you don't know what's on the other, particularly if we put aside fueling up your car for a second and we just talk about, electricity.
Or food.
Or food, right? Like, you don't know what's on the other end of that. And so that actually also makes it possible to substitute out, right? I don't, as long as I'm not paying an arm and a leg. Like, if you got, you know, if my utility is getting the power to, you know, power my apartment in Brooklyn from wind, that I don't care. You know, I don't care. I don't have any. All I want is the power to turn on. And so, and that's one of the ways that you've seen, you know, the enormously successful renewable portfolio standard policy in states across country, including in Texas, which has one of the best. Because consumers, if you just force utilities to integrate this into their system, consumers don't care. The big thing is price, right? I mean, that's the big thing. And that gets us to the ultimate way in which, you know, why I think, you know, why I'm hopeful that we can pull off a change in the political economy as profound as the abolition of slavery without, you know, fighting a horrible, brutal, unremittingly merciless, bloody war.
because we actually have the ability to not make the consumer that sensitive to the change, right? I mean, is that the argument? Is that isolating the interest?
Right. So one is right. One is that the consumers. The fact that consumer is sort of only loosely tethered to the source of the energy is one huge advantage. But the other huge one is about capital and capital intensiveness. The thing about slaves as a resource was that they required – I mean, this is why it was such a screwed up – why it was so exploitative and so – and conferred so much wealth because it required no capital, right? Like – You like barely fed people. You put like a few planks of wood over their head and gave them water, and that was it. There's no investment. And it was, you know, once you had this resource, you could just use it, right? Well, fossil fuel reserves that are in the ground are enormously capital intensive to withdraw. Enormously. Billions and tens of billions and hundreds of billions of dollars will be invested by investors external to the entities themselves, right, to draw that out of the ground. And if they start to fear that those assets won't be worth the investment, you're going to see a decline in investment. You're already seeing talks about this. And the best bet we have is kind of two different things coming together producing a kind of political solution. So at one level, what you need is you need the threat of some global policy hanging there, even if it doesn't happen. The reason you need that threat is you got to create the uncertainty in markets, in the folks that are doing capital investment in fossil fuels, that there might be a price on carbon, and that price 10 years down the line. Because remember, these reserves we're talking about are going to be drawn out over a long period of time, right? And you're building, you know, you're going to spend $500 million on some, you know, new oil field exploration now, and you want it to pay dividends over 15 years. But if in year 7 it's no longer economic because of what happens on a policy level, then that's a real risk to your capital investment, right? So what you need is you need the threat of some kind of price on carbon globally. You need that to start to scare enough capital investment away from dirty fuels. And fear of what's called stranded assets, right? Which is that you've got this money in the ground that you can't get out because it's now no longer economic to do so. That's the first dynamic that is starting to take shape, but you need to accelerate that, and I think the divestment movement and some of the pressure points there are helpful. And then what you need is you need this sort of exponential growth curve in renewables, which we are starting to see, such that you hope to get a kind of virtuous cycle where the incumbent energy interests start losing power relative to the new energy interests, and as they lose political power, then the threat of the carbon price grows more certain, and the more certain that grows, the less power they have, because then the risk that money that's in the ground won't be recoverable increases. You see what I mean? So there's this
when you talk about the growth curve in renewables, that also basically plays into what has to happen. Number one, which is to scare off investors as to the certainty of returns in the future.
Yes, exactly. And the reason is. Right, that's exactly right. And the reason that works, and the kind of Achilles heel of these industries, is particularly true with oil, actually, it's particularly true with oil, is just how capital intensive the whole thing is and the time horizons over which that capital gets recovered.
And so, and the third element, you said there were 3 points: the sort of disincentivize or sort of make the
right. So one point is a global process that's working towards the possibility of a global price on carbon. That's one. Two is the discouragement and fear about risk in the financial markets that fund capital investment for dirty fuel. And three is the incumbent energy sector growing rapidly. And, you know, again, right now we have all of those things. Now, the thing you really need is you need the price on carbon. But because that's such a difficult thing to pull off, I've become more and more convinced that you only get that once you get these kind of sort of feedback loops working on each other, right?
And so, in other words, I mean, that's where the sort of the political and social movements come in.
Exactly. That's okay. Exactly.
I mean,
right.
Let's tease that out because, you know, I guess it was a couple of years ago, Bill McKibben at 350.org and others started basically an agenda to go to college campuses and get divestment. And it is to set up, I mean, it's almost like that moral component that was there for people when they were fighting slavery, they were trying to introduce a moral component into this debate as well to get this cycle going.
That's exactly right. And they recognize, I think, the same thing it's not my recognition. They recognize it before me, which is that the investment is the kind of biggest Achilles heel. And that's why they've really focused that movement on, you know, I mean, the basic idea is pushing on two fronts. One, politically, you know, for politically to do things to keep current dirty fuel in the ground. So attack the Keystone Pipeline, right? Just don't build a huge, that's a perfect example of do not deploy a ton of resources and capital investment to get fuel out of the ground that's going to need to stay in the ground, right? So that's one. Two, push the government to do everything it can, even short of Congress, like the EPA coal-fired power plant regulations, to make the dirtiest fuel more expensive. And three, attack directly the capital funding. And again, in the grand scheme of things, you know, the divestment movement, which has been amazingly successful in certain respects, represents a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the amount of money that's floating around there. It can't be the thing that by itself kills it. But all of these things, the biggest thing is you need to destroy the political power of the incumbent interests. And one of the ways to do that is to attack them all on all fronts. Like their moral and social standing have to decline. Their actual revenues need to decline. It has to be harder for them to do business. Like you gotta and the reason that I'm hopeful about some sort of virtuous cycle is that industries in decline have less power, and having less power leads to further decline, right?
So for instance, when we're talking, you know, what happened with some with the fracking in New York State actually seems to me to be an example of you want to get into that dynamic where we had one of the biggest fracking companies interests in the country, I think, had a lot of leases in the I think it's the Marcellus Shale, and they the moratoriums and whatnot basically just led them to say, We're just walking away from these leases because we're projecting out, and the cost to actually start to sink our fracturing wells in the ground is just going to be too great for what we're actually going to pull out of it.
That's exactly right.
And that's sort of the dynamic that we're talking about.
That's exactly right. That you want to everyone's making a cost benefit analysis, and you want to, through a combination of market and political pressure, right? Because remember, the political pressure is what is the uncertain risk? What is the risk that the stuff that I build the pipeline or put the wells in to get ends up being so expensive that I don't recover my investment? So that's why there's a fascinating interplay between investment decisions being made now and the possibility of a price on carbon, which is why I think people have to understand that the political pressure towards a price on carbon moves along this spectrum that makes it less or more likely that has actual real world effects, even short of actually getting the price on carbon. Right? Because my calculation of the cost benefit of Project X is different if I think the odds of a price on carbon in 10 years is 5%, 20%, 40%, or 60%. Those are completely different returns on investment represented by those different risks. And if things are moving politically in terms of institutional pressure, social movements, et cetera, that make it look more and more likely that, you know, that we are going to get that price in 10 years, that affects my decision making now, even short of actually getting the price.
And so, I mean, we see at the very least, we see examples of this in reverse. I will go out and maybe I will try and get the license to sell medical marijuana in New York State, even though I can't do it today. But my anticipation is I'm going to be able to do it in 10 years. It's worth it. I amortize that cost over the next 10 years, and then the 30 years going forward, I'm going to get this big investment in return. The opposite can also happen. I'm not going to invest in a brewery if I anticipate prohibition. See a lot of teetotalers walking around. And so this, it was announced, I think it was 2 weeks ago, that 2 or 3 weeks ago, or at least I saw a piece, I think in the Times, about a plan underfoot at the UN to create a non-binding treaty which would set benchmarks but not require them so that we could avoid a going through the treaty process, at the very least in the U.S. Senate. But the idea is that this is just one more marker that would scare me if I'm planning to invest $1 billion in a refinery.
And your point there about the housing or brewery, I mean, I think the best analogy, which is close to that, is think about the self-fulfilling prophecy of a neighborhood that is either experiencing flight and disinvestment or is gentrifying, right? So in the 60s, when you had, you know, huge amounts of capital leave urban neighborhoods, I mean, in the form of white flight, right? The person says, you should be worried that your house is declining because the people next door moved out. And other people, unsavory people, black people, brown people are moving in. And if you don't sell now, when I come back in a month, your house is going to be worth even less. So what does that lead to? It leads to that person selling. Well, them selling then accelerates that same cycle until you have this unbelievable, you know, collapse in these neighborhoods in an incredibly quick period of time. A neighborhood my mom grew up in, the Bronx, and other places in the west side of Chicago. The same we see on the other end, right? The same is, people start buying in neighborhoods because there's an expectation that they will rise in value, and every kind of person that makes an individual decision then increases the odds of the next person making it. So all of these sort of accelerate those processes move in this kind of exponential way, which is, again, why when you're on the early part of an exponential curve, it doesn't feel like you're going very fast, and then all of a sudden you're going very fast. And that's my hope. Again, like I'm laying out the rosiest possible scenario. I mean, right. the non-rosy scenario is like we're entering era of unprecedented and consistent catastrophe, misery, suffering, and disintegration. But
you got to try and stay positive. Well, I mean, like some other examples of this, it occurs to me, would be the health insurance industry, in terms of, for a long time, I think there was a perspective that the health insurance industries understood that their industry as a whole was going into a death spiral, and that depending on whose arguments you believe, to a certain extent, the Affordable Care Act, while it brought a universality to health insurance or near universality quicker than it would be, was almost a somewhat of an ultimatum to the health insurance industry. Like, you can either enjoy this or wait until your industry starts to die, because you're in an untenable industry. And to go back to your slavery analogy, one thing that we hear, or I hear when I debate libertarians, is that we should have just paid you know, the U.S. government should have just paid everybody for the slaves, and we could have ended slavery. Right. We should have just bought all the slaves. Apparently, there was actually an attempt to do that on some level. But do you think that we will get – there's a potential that we will get to the point where we simply say, you know, it won't be as naked as that, but we're going to buy the slaves. But here's a tremendous amount of subsidies, Exxon, to promote wind energy or solar or
– I think before it's all said and done, something like that will probably be part of what happens. I think it all depends on how these processes play out. You know, I think I genuinely, and I you know, people will accuse me of being overly optimistic. What's happening in solar right now is incredible. from a price and an engineering standpoint. And it's possible that things move just incredibly quickly. That fossil fuel ends up being, you know, the landline into the home much faster than they realize they would be, in which case there's going to be less power for them to kind of extract a kind of ransom. But depending on how that power scale is calibrated, like, yeah, you know, in England, England used compensated emancipation. they paid to free the slaves. And it was expensive, and it was morally outrageous to compensate the people who had committed the crime, right?
Right.
Unquestionably. You know, in the U.S., it was impossible, partly because the South wanted nothing of it, and partly because the total cost was, like, you know, more than the government could possibly pay. You know, some kinds of essentially payoffs are going to be inevitable, and I'll give you one area where I actually would support them. I mean, coal is dying in the U.S., and coal needs to die. But that's an easy thing for me to say in Brooklyn. I don't live in Harlan County, where people depend on jobs around coal who are being brutalized by the unbelievable rapidity with which coal extraction is becoming uneconomic. And I was just down there just talking to a guy who lost his job. Like, and he's furious and upset. And he made six figures, and he's on food stamps now. And there are casualties to the destruction of the incumbent fossil fuel interests that aren't just the, you know, board of directors and the shareholders. There's real people who work for them. There's real lives at stake. And some kind of like process to make life right for them has to be part of any moral solution. And there's stuff actually around coal company pensions where I think we could, you know, people like me and you who are, you know, really committed to a kind of carbon free future, where we can throw our weight into, and I'm going to do something on this. Actually, we're going to do a whole week on coal country, where, you know, there's going to be some compensation. We got to make sure that people are taken care of.
Right. And that compensation comes in the form of directly to people who are victims of you know, victim may be a strong word, but that's basically what they are. I mean, they're victimized by the dissolution of of this industry. And then also, I would imagine, just massive amounts of subsidizing a transition and the creation of new industries that will have to replace what we get from, you know, from coal, for instance.
Yep. And so there's going to be, you know, there's a lot of money that's going to change hands in a lot of different directions if we're going to get there. And some of it will be more righteous and, you know, than other transfers. I mean, there's, you know, I the nature of something this big, I mean, you know, when you think about the Affordable Care Act and what a, you know, how kludgy that looked. And, you know, arguably healthcare is, you know, nowhere near the scale of what, well, not arguably, it's nowhere near the scale of what we're talking about with fossil fuel. So,
and just lastly, from a political standpoint, I mean, I know that we've talked about this, and, you know, you've mentioned this on your show. You've discussed it, you know, quite sort of frankly, just it's difficult to keep in the news because, you know, there was a story, August was the warmest, August, this past August was the warmest August in the history of our records keeping in the world. But that was also true of May. And it's like, okay, we've just clicked off another month. And in the context of what we do, there's not much else to talk about, right? I mean, this is sort of just an ongoing saga of, like, the guy fell off the cliff. He's still falling.
Right.
We'll let you know when he hits.
Yeah, to me, I'm always coming up with trying to come up with new ways to talk about it and cover it. And to me, it's like at a certain point, it's not news that we're breaking, like, the world's getting warmer. Like, yes, like, there's more extreme weather. Like, that's established. Like, to me, all the news is in this, the news in sort of what is new, what is fresh and dramatic is all of these things around this political economic fight. Because, you know, and I know obviously there are people, you know, I know there are people, lots of people who aren't convinced, and I'm not sure I'm going to be the one to convince them. But, you know, Bill McKibben made this point to me. I'll sort of close on this. You know, his point is that, like, we're past the project isn't persuading. Like, there's going to be some percentage of people who are not going to be persuaded, even as, like, the water, you know, takes out the South Florida coast.
Right.
It's about power. It's about organizing. And it's about, you know, there's this sort of combination between what's happening on the tech side, engineering side, sort of investment side on the renewables, and the people power of the movements that are happening across the world to push policymakers. And, like, those are the two levers. It's not like, oh, if we can get to 58% of people think the – like, that's not what's going to drive things. And my final provocative point, which I've been thinking about writing about, so I'm sort of scooping myself or giving this away, is that a real good model for the climate movement is the anti-abortion movement. When you look at attitudes towards abortion in this country, they have basically not changed since Roe. They bounce up and down. There's a little bit of evidence to say younger people are actually a little slightly more anti-abortion than their parents. But on the whole, there has not been any sort of sea change in American public policy, in American public opinion about abortion. It's muddled. It depends on the next question. Most people support Roe. Most people also support some set of restrictions, and the battles are sort of in there. That's what's happening in public opinion, fairly stable. What's happening in policy is not stable at all. We have seen an unprecedented amount of restrictionist measures passed state after state after state after state. Abortion is getting harder and harder to obtain. And that is a testament to a movement that hasn't been focusing on persuading the bulk of the public. That is a movement that has used their very highly organized, concentrated power on the levers they have to get policy change that aligns with their vision, in spite of the fact that public opinion hasn't changed. And it's, in a perverse way, it is a hopeful model.
Interesting. And I'm glad we just broke that story. I just tried to run our breaking news sound effect. It didn't work. But Chris Hayes, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And maybe we'll run into you on Sunday. At the big march.
Well, no, unfortunately, I know. Unfortunately, I'm going to be in Texas. I agreed to go to Texas, like, way before this march was organized. So, unfortunately, I'm missing it. But tonight, if people listen, Naomi Klein's going to be on. First cable news interview about her new book that changes everything. So that should be good.
Oh, great. All right. People will check that out. Thank you so much, Chris Hayes.
You bet, man.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. We're going to take a break, head into the better half. A reminder, folks, that it is your support that makes this program possible. Where else? We just broke a story on what Chris Hayes might write next. Where else are you going to get that? And I'm quite convinced if we could get 1,000 of you to become members in the next 24 hours, Hayes would agree to come on the show or at the very least drop an email and tell us what he's going to write every time before he writes again. I mean, that might take some negotiation, and I don't want to. But that's why I put the bar so high. 1,000 new members in the next 24 hours, unlikely, but I am willing to harass Hayes to find out what he's going to write in the future if we can get that stipulated. That said, you can also support this program if you buy crap from Amazon. The least you can do is buy it through our link at Majority Report. Well, it's, what is it? Majority, MajorityKickback.com?
Being serious?
Yeah, I forgot.
MajorityReportKickback.com.
MajorityReportKickback.com.
It's jointhemajoritycom to become a member.
Right.
It's MajorityReportKickback.com to support us by buying all your junk through the Amazon link. And then it is MajorityApp.com to download our 100% free app.
That's both iOS and Android, right?
Yes, that is. And then our website is Majority.fm. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/majorityreport. Our Twitter is twitter.com/majorityfm. Our YouTube channel is youtube.com/samcedar. However, if you'd like to watch the show live, it is youtube.com/majorityreportlive.
Jesus.
Woo! And then donate your account to donate your Twitter, Facebook account to the Majority Report, and we will tweet out, Facebook share on your pages. One YouTube video or show per day.
Wow. There you go. You're hired, Matt. I don't know where Michael is with this stuff. He can't even find the website. It's majority.fm, Matt and Michael. Did you say justcoffee.coop?
You could also, but that's not really ours. But yes, just maybe. Well, maybe but we that is a, maybe we need a maybe we need an MR Coffee website as well.
I can't afford to keep buying all these URLs. $15 a year. I'm gonna go broke with all these specialty URLs. It's justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. You can
use coupon code Majority to get 10% off your entire order.
Jeez. Somebody's bucking for a raise around here. All right, we're going to take a break. The number is 646-257-3920. What did I just say? That's not even the right number, is it? 646-257-3920 is the number.
You need to take care of that one, too.
646-257-3920. I don't know what has happened to me. We've got Scottish Independence today, and anticipate hearing from some folks from that side of the Atlantic. And we've got some sound. I heard this. This is not earth shattering, and it's not even, but Greg Gutfeld and Eric Bolling, they just, I've been doing this for 10 years now. You know, at one point, I'm not going to react to some idiocy that I hear on Fox, but it is a combination of how nauseating it is to see these guys who I have at least some semblance of how much money they're making basically just crap on poor people. And then lie in service of spreading that sense that we need to shame poor people, that poor people are somehow getting away with something. And I should say people who are living in poverty, because the reality is that 1 in 4 in this country will dip into poverty at one point or another during their lives. And that's but we will break down their latest series of lies. I'm trying not to swear. So we got to take a break. 646-257-3920. Of course, you can IM me through the app at majorityapp.com. And you can IM us through AIM at Majority FM. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hey,